So it's wonderful to be here. I also had a sense of homecoming almost in a way, though I've never been here before, because Bob was one, and you know this already, one of the first to understand what was happening in this country. And when he, in what, 73, I think, wrote Evangelicals on the Canterbury Trail, he was clearly right on. And when he invented and gave to what we're here to talk about the term ancient future, he nailed it to the barn door, as we say in the country. So in many ways, it's bringing things home. We are few enough in number and with enough time so that I want to take the luxury of boring you to death for about 15 or 20 minutes with the details, all right? Because I think ultimately it helps. A lot of you obviously have read The Great Emergence, or if you haven't, you're familiar with the theory, because it certainly is not proprietarily mine, nor does it belong just to that book. You've heard it somewhere or other. So I want to clean up some rhetoric, the kind of thing you don't do in a book, because it's for popular consumption. But because we are all here involved as professionals, to some greater or lesser extent in ministry, I think it matters that we know what we're talking about. And for that reason, I'm going to first of all say that what we're talking about is the religious presentation of a much larger construct. And it's terribly important that we understand that. I hope some of you are Twittering. Are any of you Twittering? Oh, I mean right now. Oh, good. I discovered in December I did my first meeting in a huge nave with about 400 people there, and they had wired the thing. Tony Jones came in and wired the puppy for Wi-Fi and then put two great screens on either side of the dais like this. And about two-thirds of the audience had computers. And they were Twittering like this, and then you could see out of the corner of your eye what they were Twittering, which was amazing experience. It was right up until out of the corner of my eye, I saw Twitter go by, what the hell did she just say? That might not be entirely appropriate in the name of a cathedral, but it's amazing how much it increases the concentration and the ability to follow. I want to begin by saying that emergence, or the great emergence, really is a social construct. And in order to do that, I would like for you, those of you who have read the book, have heard the metaphor before, but especially when one is talking with professional clergy or professional ministers, it's important, or even devout Christians, it's important to be very clear what we're talking about when we separate religion as an institution out from private faith. And they're two entirely different things. And what I'm going to be talking about these 2 days is the institution, or religion as a social construct. And it helps, I think, if you understand that religion, religion is like a little boat out in the water that is attached up here to a dock, which is God, or which is ultimate meaning, if you will have it be that. Religion's function in a society is to answer the question of what is the point? What is the meaning here? Why are we doing this? Life is too hard for us not to have some sort of time. If there are only two or three of us gathered together, we will begin to ask the question, why? Why in the world are we here? What is this all about? Why are we going through this? And that ultimate answer we call God, regardless of where we come from. And that's kind of like a dock. And religion is out here with the answer out to the people, and it's connected to the dock by a waterproof cable. And that waterproof cable is the same regardless of the religion you're talking about, all right? And the waterproof cable is composed of 5 parts, the outside part of which is a genuinely waterproof casing, and that's the story. That is, it's our common understanding of what it is that we are. It's our definition of us. It's the story. It's George Washington cutting down the cherry tree with his little hatchet. And if you believe that happened, you're pathetic and you belong somewhere else. You know, but it speaks to the fact that we believe that that's the best of the American spirit, is that I cannot tell a lie. Well, if you believe that, you really are in trouble. But anyway, we see that as our American story. And there are many other parts to our American story that aren't so easily spit. Inside of that, there is a loosely knit mesh sleeve, and that's what I call the common imagination. Bill Griffin calls it the consensual illusion. Some people call it the consensual imagination. Doesn't matter. It simply means that it's that thing that we all, as a society, however big or small that society is, we all agree that this is the truth. It doesn't have to be right. Please understand that. It does not have to be accurate or correct. It just has to be thing we all agree is true. To put it at a simplistic level, there was a time when the earth was flat because we all thought it was flat. And it didn't matter that it wasn't flat, because as long as we knew it was flat, we weren't going to go anywhere near the edge. And therefore, we were constricted or informed, whatever you want, or shaped, if you will, by what our consensual illusion or our common imagination was about. Inside that loosely knit, constantly subject to change, consensual illusion, there's an interior braid, and it's composed of three parts. Three parts. The first is spirituality. And with all due respect, I'm much more hesitant to define spirituality now than I was even 10 years ago. We've used the word now so that it means so many things to so many people, I'm a little leery of it. But for purposes of economy of conversation, let's say that spirituality really is the interior presentation of that which we believe is the meaning. The second part is corporeality. Corporeality is a $10 word for everything that is the physical presence that a religion exists in an institutional form. That is, it's the church building, it's this building as a church-related school, it's the prayer books we use, it's the collars some of you wear, it's the salary you get, it's your pension plan, it's the priest scandals in the Roman church right now and in some other branches of the church. It's everything, it's the creeds, it's the holy scriptures, it's everything that proves it exists. And the third is morality. And again, for purposes of ease of talking, morality is the exterior or external presentation of what it is that we believe, or that we believe something. Now, everything works just fine for a while. Everything goes along just swimmingly, and then something comes along and it will pock or prick a little hole in the story. And the thing will seep a little water, but it's okay. Every once in a while, as the little boat rocks like this, the mesh sleeve will begin to give a little bit, and it'll open a little space, and the consensual illusion will have a little kind of snag in it, but it's okay, because the boat continues to rock. This is a very nautical metaphor, in case you hadn't noticed. Okay, the little boat will continue to rock, and eventually the mesh sleeve will go back where it's supposed to be. But every once in a great while, in the Western world, informed by Latin Christianity, I just said something significant. Every once in a while, like every 500 years, the story and the consensual illusion or common imagination will simultaneously take a pock. And when that happens, the water seeps in. And when that happens, as the water seeps in, inevitably, we being what we are as human beings, we put our fingers in and we pull out the interior braid and we pull it out strand by strand and we begin to fool with it. And inevitably, as we do it in the order I gave them to you. We will play with spirituality until we think we've got a new definition for it or some understanding of it, and we'll stick it back in the hole and we'll bring out corporeality and play with that for a while till we think we know what we've got, and then we'll stick it back in and we'll bring out morality and play with that. After we've wearied our fingers and the braid, we stuff the whole thing back in, we give the consensual illusion a tug or two, and then we do something analogous to theological duct tape, I suppose, and close off the story, and everything's fine again for about another 500 years. Why? Have not a clue. Do not know why. But it's important to realize and to remember right here and now that the thing we're going through began with people saying, I'm spiritual but not religious. Heard that one lately? Uh-huh. Yes. I think I'll throw up if one more person says it to me. It's a lot like saying, I'm a human being but not flesh and blood. It makes about as much sense. Morality is very much, corporeality is very much on the radar screen right now. Those of you who have been through the trauma of a new hymn book, or or new music, or even the minor annoyance of trying to get a drop-down screen, are aware that corporeality is hot on the thing. Morality is just now beginning in the thing we're going through, just now beginning to come and play. at a popular or overwhelming level, it really began with Terri Schiavo. Terri Schiavo became the first, and perhaps some would say, some who do this would say, it began with the abortion issue and the politicization of the abortion issue that preceded. But certainly by the time you get to Terri Schiavo, that poor housewife who had been 19 years unconscious and whose family wanted to pull the plug, and the whole country got in an uproar over the thing. And so we're just now beginning to realize we have a need for a new moral code based on a new understanding of what it is to be human. So what it is to say that about every 500 years we go through one of these things. I just gave it to you in terms of religion, but there's a big sea out there, and it's the big sea in which the ship is floating that makes the snag and makes the tear and makes the mesh sleeve move. It's the moving of the sea. Now, the sea is society. And the thing we're in right now is called the Great Emergence. It is not the religious presentation. It is the whole economic, cultural, intellectual, societal, domestic, everything is in an uproar right now. And we need to understand that before we go any farther. Yes, the church is in an uproar. But it's in an uproar because it's a little tiny boat on a very large sea, which is in an uproar. When Fakhrit Zakatas, who is the economic advisor or analyst or whatever for Time magazine, and he's now gone to CNN also, do you know of whom I speak? If you listen to him, he speaks frequently of mergenomics. What he's talking about is the fact that what the globe is going through right now economically has to do with the fact that we're in the process of going through the Great Emergence. And what we're in right now is the economic presentation of it. Yes, there was greed. Yes, there was all kinds of stuff. But he's absolutely right. This is that when somebody says to you, do you understand that in this country now, for the first time ever, more of us live in domestic units, more of us, not many, but not huge majority, but a majority of us now live in domestic units that are not man, wife, and their children. We live in a different and very often unpartnered, but certainly unsanctioned by benefit of clergy, society. That's the Great Emergence. When we say that we are deeply involved to the point that the New York Times this morning, and I checked to see before I came over, that the New York Times now gives three major articles to Iran's election yesterday, why in the hee-haw would a huge country like the United States of America give any concern at all to this little tiny thing you could put three times in Texas? It's emergence. It's emergence because now, in the same way that the Reformation gave us cash as the basis of authority, that information is now the basis of authority and technology. And Iran can smush us all over the face of the globe if it wishes to. Uncontrolled, Iran can do huge damage. Uncontrolled, it can take away our oil. Oh, my culpa. But it can also bomb us. South Korea? You can fit South Korea in Florida. And yet we are held, North Korea, I mean, we are held hostage to it. It's the growth of globalization. That's emergence. That's the change from a nation state to a globalized situation. It's our addiction to information. Do you know how many of you are using computers right now? What in the world is going on? Would you have done that 10 years ago when this place opened? No. You know? And who's to say that you're not every once in a while hitting the little button up there that takes you straight out to the internet and to your email? So in case this lags, you can go gay. It's this total awareness that when you get home at night, you are so tired of knowing stuff. You can't bear knowing another thing. You don't want another fact or factoid in your head. All you want to do is go to the kitchen and start happy hour. And as you do that, even if you're not Episcopalian, some of you closet drinkers, I bet you you've got whatever. Anyway, whatever. Maybe it's a cup of coffee. Let me do the devil's thing. But whatever. When you head to the kitchen, what do? You flip the switch on the home computer. That's addiction. That's serious addiction. That's also the Great Emergence. All right, it is also true that in this country, in 1900, 14% of us lived inside of what could be called city, what was city limits. We were urbanized, at least by our residents, if nothing else. In 2006, 83% of us are urbanized. That's a huge shift. There's a wonderful book called Nobody Can Make a Lead Pencil. I can't remember the author, and it's not on your bibliography, because it's 200 pages of making a simple point, which is that a plain lead pencil, which your great-granddaddy made for your great-great-granddaddy made for your great-granddaddy to go to school with, you cannot make a lead pencil now in this country without going through 204 procedures. That is to say, 204 different sets of hands are involved. The rubber comes from one place and has to be harvested. The tin that makes the thing that holds the eraser on it has to come from somewhere else. The ability to crimp the tin goes to a different factory. The ability to pour and shape the rubber goes to a different one. The wood has to be harvested and shipped into China in order to be taken. The paint has to be especially treated so kids chewing on it won't die of lead poisoning. Your great-granddaddy didn't have that protection, and it just was a little foggy in his brain, and it was the lead pencil. Who knew? The lead itself has 204 procedures. That's emergence. And all of these things impact. Yes, it makes you very tired, right? Of course it does, if you think about it. It also deeply, that's the sea on which the little boat is rocking and on which, across which the cable is stretched. Why does it happen every 500 years? Nobody knows. I'd be very, very suspicious of somebody who said he or she knew why it happens every 500 years. If it helps to take it out of the metaphor of the sea, let's use Mark Dyer as a bishop in the Episcopal Church, retired now teaching instead of serving in the episcopacy. And he says that what you have to understand where the church is right now, is that about every 500 years, the church feels compelled to have a giant rummage sale, and we're having one. And that domesticates it. He also is very quick to say that you also have to understand that rummage sales are good. That is to say that you get rid of a lot of junk. You make contact with a lot of stuff, and you dump it. And then he goes on and says, but also in going through your attic and your closets, you find some things that you had lost in the debris. Things that you had stuck back for various and sundry reasons. Things that you care about. There was that chair that your great-grandma gave you when you married. You didn't have the money to reupholster it, and so you put it in the attic. You always loved the chair. It's got great memories, but you couldn't put it in your living room. And you bring it down, and you realize, I've got the money now. I can reupholster it. And you put it in a place of pride and love on it. You know, there's the picture frame with Uncle Bill in it. You couldn't stand Uncle Bill. And so when your mother gave you the frame, you thought, I can't look at the old boy. And you turned him to the wall upstairs in the attic. And you find him again, and you realize, I can cut Uncle Bill out. He's dead now, and so is Mama. But I really like the frame. And so you put a new treasure in an old frame. And that's exactly what's happening in this one. Now, when I call it the Great Emergence, or when Fercreet uses the term, or when anybody who talks about it calls it the Emergence, what are we talking about, and where does that name come from? I'm very careful these days not to talk about emerging Christianity or emergent Christianity, to be really sure we talk about emergence Christianity, and there's a reason for that. Those of you who remember church history, and you all do, of course, will remember that Martin Luther with the 95 on the door of Wittenberg, and if you think he put 95 on the door, you're crazy. He did the 95, but apparently he didn't put them on the door. It's a lovely myth, like George Washington, but it makes a nice story. The ink wasn't dry on those things before they began to fight. Remember Marburg Castle and Zwingli and Luther meeting, and they both declared each the other was a pig? And you can't really, you know, even pigs can't make fun with pigs, especially if they're human beings. It was not 10 years into the Reformation before we began to get that divisiveness, before we began to quarrel amongst ourselves. In the same way, emergence Christianity is already engaged in factionalism and in divisiveness. Emergent Christianity is a very specific, increasingly specific thing now. Emerging Christianity is a broader thing. Emergence Christianity is what we really ought to be talking about. Emergence Christianity in the UK, Australia, New Zealand, in the former colonies of the UK, is now generally called fresh expressions. We'll get to that later. But when you see fresh expressions, you're talking about one presentation, primarily in the UK and its former colonies, of emergence Christianity. But for our purposes in this country, emerging and emergent are the primary words used. Increasingly, you will find scholars talking about generative or convergent Christianity to try to get away from the conflict that's growing. Now, since we're all professional Christians, we are aware that the church never has any internal buses. So we're going to be amazed to discover that there's one here of sizable proportions. All emergence Christians in this country are, to some greater extent or lesser, emerging. Fewer of them are emergent than are emerging. Mars Hill in Seattle is pastored by a man named Mark Driscoll, whom some of you may know. It is an emerging church. It is probably the poster child of emerging that is not emergent. Mars Hill in Grand Rapids is pastored by Rob Bell, whom many of you know, who is more or less an emergent, emerging Christian teaching emergence Christianity. The difference is that Driscoll, for instance, is homophobic, and Marsh Hill in Seattle is homophobic. There are no women allowed to speak. There is a real conservatism about the use of Scripture. There are all of those things that makes it very close to a new form of evangelicalism, and I mean no offense now, I'm trying to speak clearly rather than offensively. Over at Marsh Hill in Grand Rapids, women do speak. I've occupied that pulpit two or three times now. Women do speak. Gay issue is just such yesterday's news that nobody even remembers to ask the question. There is an earnest struggle to see what it is that Scripture is saying and an openness to be able to investigate it and to see what it says in view of everything we now know. It is a whole different spectrum. Emergence Christianity overcomes them all. Now, it happens every 500 years, I said a minute ago, in those societies informed by Latin Christianity. As you will remember, when the church, first century church, came along, there were three grand divisions of Christianity. There was the Latin church, the Greek church, and the Syriac church. They were so named according to the principal language through which they got their scriptures. That's all it meant. The Latin church informed what we come from, informed Europe and the Caucasian part. The Greek informed the middle part, and the Syriac informed primarily the East. Those divisions were not in place until about the 3rd or 4th century. They all worshiped together in Rome according to the language which was their principal language. And that was all it was. By the time you get to the Council of Chalcedon, we are getting rid of the Syriac church. By the time you get to 780, and Philip Jenkins, who's on the bibliography, is the scholar of choice in all of this stuff. And if you're not familiar with Jenkins' work, you need to go worry about it. You need to read Philip Jenkins and what he has to say about the early church and the present church internationally or globally. By the time you get to 780 and Timothy the Great is made Catholicus of the Syriac Church, he is now the head of somewhere close to a third of Christianity. But Chalcedon has drummed him out, or has drummed his faith out, and he is now occupying Baghdad. That's where his principal see is. He's living in Baghdad, and he's spreading Christianity as far as India, and old Christianity in China comes straight out of Timothy's missional push. In the 8th century, all the way to the east. The Greek Christianity we're going to get rid of at the Great Schism to some extent. And we're going to have left the Latin experience. Those of us who are informed, I'm not talking just Roman Catholic, I'm talking every Baptist here present, every Pentecostal. It is Latin Christianity that we descend from. And it is Latin Christianity that goes through this thing. It is not to say, however, that it is limited just to Christianity. I said a minute ago, you don't know what happens, why it happens, what causes it. And that's absolutely true. Because if you were a Jewish audience, so the good rabbi would stand up and say, what you're talking about when you say every 500 years this thing happens also is true in Judaism. That is to say, I can say to you that 500 years ago we were in the Great Reformation, right? And 500 years before that, we were in the great schism or schism, according to how your mama grew up and what she taught you to say, you know. Either way, it's an ecclesial itch. I can't say the word without wanting to scratch. But we were in it. 500 years before that, we were in the great decline and fall, which ecclesially presents, to some extent at least, as the Council of Chalcedon in 451. And 500 years before that, we were in the great transformation, the change of the era. But the good rabbi would say, oh, good for you boys. But 500 years before the great transformation, we were in the Babylonian captivity. And the end of First Temple Judaism, the beginning of Second Temple Judaism. And 500 before that, we were in the end of the Age of Judges and the coming of the Davidic dynasty. And he would say, what you have is a Judeo-Christian phenomenon within that part of the world that has been informed by Latin Christianity. And if you don't think the good rabbi is telling you the truth, go Google Synagogue 3000. Not now, but Google Synagogue 3000 when you get home. And you will see the presentation of a great emergence as it's occupying the minds and hearts of contemporary Judaism within the area informed by Latin Christianity. Or go look at the Etz Chaim, the new Pew Bible, or Torah. That came out now some 3 years ago, which says quite frankly that in all probability there was not a Moses or a Sinai, that what we have, the head snapped. It says it in the footnotes in the back, but if you get really bored listening to the rabbi, you always read the footnotes if you're Jewish. And it just says it is the narrative that saves us, and it is the narrative that has the truth, and not the particulars. So Judaism is very much going through this. Now, if we were a really mixed audience, a good imam present would stand up and say, and I've had two or three of them now slap me upside the head and say, don't stop there, go all the way, would stand up and say that it happens in Islam, at least in the part of Islam that is informed by Latin Christianity or that has any kind of intercourse, if you will, with the parts of the world that come out of Latin Christianity. he would then say it just doesn't look like it simply because we're 650 years off from the rest of you, by which he or she means there was, effectively speaking, no real Islam until near the end of the 7th century. But if you look at it from then on, you see that every 500 years, they also go through this thing. They go through, and they are presently entering into what more Islamicists than I can count now have said is the coming of Islam's Reformation. That what we did 500 years ago, they are now entering. And they say, look at the Wasabi, look at the Taliban, look at Al-Qaeda, look at the huge fights that are going on now. I used to be in the publishing business, and so I still receive notices from publishers, including Islamic ones, and it is absolutely true now that two or three books out of every list of forthcoming books from Islamic publishers in this country and in the UK will have something about the Reformation in Islam, so that there is confirmation empirically as well as in a scholarly way that they're going through it. So that's what happens to us. Now, what do we need to know before we really get started on this? See, you thought I'd started. I haven't. I told you I was going to warn you for 30 minutes, but yeah, and give you the working tools. What we have, and I just did it a minute ago, is that for whatever reason, whether it's Abrahamic or Judeo-Christian or particular to Christianity, and by and large, I'm going to limit myself now from here on out to religion and to religion in North America, and by default to Christianity, since it's the dominant religion in the North American experience. For whatever reason, within the world that's informed by Latin Christianity or where Latin Christianity holds a vital place, every 500 years we do this. We are doing it right now, and it's the Great Emergence. 500 years ago, as I said, it was called the Great Reformation. The Great Reformation, if you will remember from high school or college or whenever you had it, gave us the rise of capitalism, the rise of the middle class, the rise of the nation state, and the rise of Protestantism. The great blessing of the Reformation was that it is clearly, and we can have no trouble conceptualizing as a great, overarching, completely sociological, intellectual, complete change in society, and the religion that came out of it had a different name, Protestantism. one of the problems with the one we're in right now that justifies the last 25 minutes of making an issue of it is that we're in the great emergence and we've gotten emergence Christianity out of it, which leads very often to a confusion of what it is you're talking about when you're talking about emergence, unless you put the Christianity word to it. But the Reformation had the grace to give it a new name. 500 years before that, we had the Great Schism or the Great Schism, and that's to give it its Christian name. And before that, we had the Great Decline and Fall, which is the decaying of Rome. And before that, as I said, the Great Transformation. Now, I grew up calling the Great Transformation the Axial Age, and probably most of you did too. It so happens that Karen Armstrong, bless her heart, wrote a very popular book, The Great Transformation, about 4 or 5 years ago. And it was so popular that that name got changed. So when the era's changed, now it's called The Great Reformation. Thank you, Ms. Armstrong. There is also a certain fascination with the word great that you may have noticed going by. The Great Schism, thankfully, was always The Great Schism. The Reformation was just The Reformation when I was a kid. It has become The Great Reformation. By extension. The emergence is very often called just the emergence, and increasingly those of us who wish to be playful or have a sense of humor about it have stuck the great in front of it just to keep everything, the great awakening, the great enlightenment, the, you know, to keep the greats there. I want to look at them all together before we take a break, please, in order to make a couple of points. First of all, please be aware that every time one of these things has happened, whatever held pride of place religiously, whatever form of Christianity held hegemony, did not die. It simply had to drop back and regroup and reconfigure itself and then go on. Catholicism did not cease to exist 500 years ago. Orthodoxy did not cease to exist 1,000 years ago. Coptic or Ethiopian or Syriac Christianity did not cease to exist 1,500 years ago. Judaism did not cease to exist 2,000 years ago. Whatever has held hegemony has to drop back. 500 years ago, we called it the Council of Trent. And we also called it the Hundred Years' War, but that's an unfortunate side of it. But we called it the Council of Trent. When Catholicism regrouped and did many of the things Luther had asked for, seminaries being one of them. The reason we sit here is that the Council of Trent and Luther both agreed we need trained clergy. And so we got the seminaries out of it. It did not cease to exist. The second thing is that Christianity always spread farther as a result. Every time one of these has happened, the level or the extension of Christianity has always expanded both demographically and geographically. The third thing is that every time one of these things has happened, there has been one central informing question, and it's the same question every time. And that question is, where now is our authority? Or put another way, how now shall we live? What gets lost is the authority that held the last 500 years together. And the question then becomes, so now what do we do? There are always two or three. When I say subordinate questions, I make myself nervous because they're not exactly subordinate. They're just particular to the upheaval. They are certainly ancillary questions, if you will. The emergence has three questions. Some of them have only had two, but the emergence has three. The first of our questions is, where is our theology of religion? And that is to say, ask a different way, how do those of us who are passionately involved with Christianity, who believe it to be the truth, who wish the world to know it, live in, aha, Twitter is coming in. Somebody wants you to tweet. How do we live in civil equanimity, if you will? How do we live in polity, in peaceful polity, with people who are equally devout in other faiths that are contradictory of Christianity? How is it that I, as a Christian, can share civic space and cultural implications with a Hindu, a Muslim, a Sikh, any of those who wish to, especially, of course, the question is Islam. How do I live with militant Islam? And it is a question that if you're watching at all right now, and watched, and I hope you did, the European Union's votes 2 days ago, you're aware that there's trouble gathering in the European Union. The rightists carried that vote, and it was a direct blow against the Muslims who have immigrated into the continent. And there's going to be trouble. I don't think it takes a rocket scientist to see that we're going to have a 100 years war over it. We don't have a theology of religion, especially one that will allow Christian particularities and Christian exclusivists, which I can't ever say, any freedom to live gently with their fellow citizens of a different persuasion. Since I'm a Christian particularist, I'm really eagerly looking for somebody to solve this one. I know I am tired unto death of that dadgum Hindu elephant and the five blind Hindus who go looking to see what the elephant is. You know that story? If I hear it one more time, I'm going to just kill somebody. Yeah. And we've now got to the mountain with five paths going up to it. And you can't, as you travel the path, see the fellow on the other path. But when you get to the top, God is going to be there and you all will have arrived at the same place. Well, my reaction to that is crude enough, so I won't share it with you. But I don't believe that for a minute. But that leaves the central question. And it's central simply because it's the one that faces out most to the sea that's in turmoil. That it faces out most to the whole cultural and political scene in which this church lives. And we have not solved it. There is in your bibliography a book called The Theology of Religion by Veli Matti Karkkainen, who, in my humble opinion, is probably doing the best job right now in trying to work through those problems. He is Ed Fuller. He is a Fuller. Some of you who watched Ecclesial News will be aware that during the last year of the Bush administration, Professor Karkkainen, who is Finnish, was exported from this country. He was thrown out and sent back to Finland with a great uproar on the part of much of the Christian community in this country, because he's certainly a leading scholar, especially in this. And the immigration position under the Bush administration was that he was an alien and his visa had expired. And the evangelical answer was, but he teaches at a seminary, and those who teach at seminaries are indeed immune. They may stay as long as they're gainfully employed by that seminary. And the Bush administration countered by saying, Fuller Seminary is not a seminary. To be a seminary, you have to be owned by a church and or a denomination. And since it's owned interdenominationally, you all should be feeling a little angst here. Yes.
I'm getting nervous.
Good. I'm glad I got Jim's attention. And on that basis, they exported him. They deported him, I guess I should say. And the whole community rose up across all lines, rose up and said, bring him back. And immigration had to concede. Nonetheless, those who are employing foreigners in a seminary, unless they are owned by a particular denomination, have a little. It's ridiculous. And I will always believe that part of the reason for going after Karkkainen, because there are other people at Fuller who are also going after him, was the theology of religion, was the fact that he's trying to work his way to a place where Christians can also live at peace in their polity with other members who are equally devout in other faiths. He has not solved it for folk like me or for evangelicals. And basically, I'm an evangelical Anglican, which is not an oxymoron looking for a place to park. It really is possible to be an evangelical Anglican. And for those who feel a need to share the gospel, who feel a need to go out and give it, whether it's asked for or not, it's especially difficult. The second one is the one I mentioned a minute ago briefly with Terry Schiavo, and that is we no longer know what it is to be human. That one also has appeared before, but never as overwhelmingly as it has this time. We truly do not know the definition of the human being. We do not know what the mind is. We do not know what consciousness is. We do not know how we differ from the other animals. This is a result of a lot of things we will be looking at shortly, but it is nonetheless true. We now know that brain is an organ, like heart is an organ, like liver is an organ, and that brain produces certain messages which probably are mind, and mind is not us, and neither is consciousness, and neither is autobiographical self, which was the last to go. And so therefore, what are we? And we haven't a clue. And the reason Shaivo mattered was it was the first time that the public, that the public had to deal with the fact that we didn't know whether anybody was in there. And we didn't know who it was that was in there if somebody were. The abortion issue really springs out of the same confusion, and had it not politicized early, it probably would have led to the question, a cleaner presentation of the question, earlier. Shaivo is the pivot point. I do clergy things from time to time, and about 4 or 5 years ago, I got the notion to give out index cards and say, don't sign these. Do give me the year of your birth. That's all I want. And complete the sentence, the soul is. I did it 2 times and I quit. If I'm going to be an iconoclast, I like to at least anticipate it so I can enjoy the process. You know, I don't like to be surprised. Both times I got back about half the cards with only the year of birth. We're in the business of saving souls, and we don't know what they are. About a fourth of them gave me the straight seminary answer, which wasn't worth any more than the label on last night's soup that you heated in the microwave. And the others wandered over and eventually said, I don't know. That should frighten us. It frightens emergence Christianity, that we cannot define the human animal. Now, it showed up in the Reformation, if you remember. And Descartes finally answered it, but it took him about 75 years after 1517, after the 95 that didn't get tacked on the door. It was not until about 1590 that Descartes finally answered the question. How long? And every time I do Descartes, I just have to get it over with. Do you remember Monty Python? I have to say it. Granny Descartes, that drunken old fart, I think therefore I am. Get it out of my system. Yeah. What Descartes said was, I doubt everything. If I doubt, then there must be somebody doing the doubting. And therefore, as long as I can doubt, it wasn't I think, it was I doubt, but you know, it got translated, whatever. And so we get cognito ergo sum. But that's how we got. And for almost 500 years it held. It doesn't hold anymore. And so consequently, and the third question which fascinates me, and Bob Weber knew this, was the other thing, he didn't write as much about it, but Bob Weber knew this, I talked to him enough to know he knew this, is the nature of the atonement. We have no clue right now about the nature. Emergence Christianity is dead positive, absolutely. I'll finish this sentence by supper. We are working, as you know, under a definition of the atonement that was Ansel of Canterbury in the 11th century. The doctrine or the dogma or the whatever you want to call it, the theory of the atonement, is only 1,000 years old. That does not say that Ansel, I mean, I have to be loyal to Canterbury, this does not say that Ansel didn't have some footnotes. He did. He had some scriptural references. But his interpretation of it is uniquely his. And why it is held for 1,000 years beats me. Abelard challenged it. Those of you who remember church history will remember that Peter Abelard challenged it very seriously, but it didn't go anywhere because Abelard was connected with some other problems that sort of diverted public attention from his scholarship. Probably diverted his, too. Whatever. But anyway, what we've got is a doctrine that even St. Augustine, who really needs some reconsideration, Augustine became the poster boy of emergence Christianity in this country for a while, or at least popular Christianity, and he needs some serious re-looking at, too. Amen. I mean, golly, come on, you know. The only thing I like about him is Monica and her pears, but that's all right. You know, he liked his mama. What can I say? I have 7 kids. You know, you better like your mama. I'll knock you upside the head. But we've got this 1,000-year thing of penal substitution or whatever you want to call it. And emergence Christians are very sure of 2 things. Don't tell me that an omnipotent God, really all-powerful, couldn't find a better way to solve it. Ergo, it's the wrong solution, or he's not omnipotent. Take your pick, and I'll argue with you according to whichever one you pick. That's the emergence position. If he's all-powerful, then he didn't do it this way. because it doesn't make any sense. And secondly, don't ask me to follow a God as a father figure who sacrifices everything he's got. The only kid he bred, he's going to get rid of. That's not my definition of father. Now, that's a cynical way to put it. But it's absolutely the way emergence Christians will put it to you. And maybe some of your own congregants have put it to you that way. I was amazed, and Bob knew that this was the weakness. He saw it, and he would talk about it. He didn't write about it. So far as I know, he didn't write about it. He wrote so much, and maybe I didn't, but he didn't. But he knew this was going to be the weakness. This is the place where traditional, in terms of 1,000 years, orthodox, in terms of what you all went to seminary or wherever you went with, came up being taught. And this one is off the radar screen. The problem is, as with authority and a theology of religion and a definition of the human animal, we don't have a definition of the atonement, of why the crucifixion had to happen. Last night I spoke about the ascension, most of you were there, because it's great to be Easter people, but we also have to be ascension people and Pentecostal people. It's the three in combo that are the mystery of Christianity. Mm-hmm. And what happened when we function, and it really is a function of the traditional or the 1,000-year-old vision of the atonement that took away the ascension from us, that fixed it so we failed to realize resurrection happened all the time. And when we got so smart and started calling it resuscitation, we parked it and never saw the rest of the New Testament. Talks about the fact they didn't all believe him. They saw him. They ate with him. They touched him. But they didn't all believe that it was any great shakes other than a holy man. They went back to fishing. It's not until the ascension that they well together and become a church and become ready to receive the third part of their great mystery, Pentecost. And it comes straight out of this particular problem.